From the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance here at Texas A&M University. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I'm so pleased that you took the time to download us and you're listening. Every week we bring you interesting people in the world of sports medicine and human performance, and sometimes in general health, and this week is no exception. We have Dr. Michael Thornton with us, who is an assistant clinical professor here in health and kinesiology. Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to tell the audience a little bit about you and kind of give us an intro as to why we're here. Dr. Thornton has a variety of different academic degrees. He has a master's degree in sports administration and coaching from Northwestern State University in Louisiana, which was a counterpoint to where I graduated in Louisiana. He went on and got a EDD in physical education, sports management, and coaching from Texas A&M. And he's been here for how many years?
I think we're working on 16 years now.
16 years. Yeah, at one point, he was an assistant men's basketball coach at Northwestern. Mm-hmm. So he's been on the coaching side of things. And we've brought him here to talk to us about his experiences as a basketball official, because he's certified and officiates both at the high school level and at the collegiate level, Division I collegiate level.
Correct.
So, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. So, you know, today we're going to, you know, if you have any jokes about officials that you would like to use, Mike, you're more than welcome to. I will say that, tell the audience, he did wear his glasses today, so I'm sure you'll hear that a lot, right?
I do. I try not to wear these during games.
So let's just start off. What mentality do you embrace while officiating?
I guess it goes into the same mentality that I took into in my coaching when I was coaching and in the academic field that I'm involved in. I approach every game wanting to go out and give my best effort. You know, one of the things we say in our little pregame, our officials get together and we say that we want to be the best team on the court, that we want to work harder than the other two teams are working. That's our primary mentality, is that when we leave the court, we leave knowing that we've given our best effort to those kids.
Right. And I think probably a great goal for officials is to, because I refereed high school basketball for a while, is you don't want people to notice you. If they don't know you were there, then you've basically succeeded to some extent.
Yeah, you want to go and notice. You want the kids to play the game. We're actually a very critical part of the game. I think it's one of the things I've learned since I've become an official, just how important a role that is. But so you're involved in the game, but you want the kids to dictate and determine what goes on the court. Yeah. You're just there to adjudicate the rules.
Yeah, and we talked to a guy named John Wertheim who wrote a book a couple years ago, but he talked a lot in that book about good officials know when to make the call and when to stay out of the game. And that you find that as well?
Yeah, I think what happens as you move up in the levels, I know for me, when I started in the officiating gig quite late. I was in my early 30s when I started officiating, and now you're seeing that people are beginning this as early as 17, 18 years old. And I work with guys who are in their 20s. They've been a referee in Division I basketball for a few years already. But as I moved up, you know, from junior high to high school, from girls to boys, from small college to bigger college, you see, sometimes it's easier to stay out of the way as the players get a little bit better. Mm-hmm. It's actually easier to officiate the game and kind of step back and just let the plays happen.
Yeah. I was watching a game last night on TV, and I was amazed at how much they were letting go. It was a major college game, and you know, a couple top 10 ranked teams.
And typically when you have two evenly matched teams, it's much easier. You can kind of say, well, there was a bump here, and did it create a disadvantage? If it didn't, then we're going to go ahead and continue. Now, I will tell you that is a topic of debate among officials going on right now, especially at the collegiate level, is at what point do you referee strictly by the rule book, and at what point do you allow some subjectivity to come into the game? And I don't know which way is the best way. I know for me, I'm more comfortable when I'm able to look at a play and in my mind say that was advantageous or disadvantageous based on the rules, not based on what happened with the play, but on the rules state that was an illegal contact. So blow the whistle. It's just much easier when you do it that way.
Well, to some extent, as physical as the game is nowadays, if you called everything, the game would be 4 hours long.
We would like to get home at a decent time. I had a game last night. It was we drove to a high school playoff game in North Tyler. The game started at 7. Game finished about 10 minutes till 9. It was a long game. There was a lot of fouling. One team was better than the other. So in the second half, we mostly had junior varsity players playing, trying to get their minutes. They hadn't played much all year. There's a lot of fouls, a lot of substituting in and out. And you have to call those because you still got to get the plays that matter. You can't not blow your whistle or bad things happen. So.
Sure. Well, what made you take the jump from coaching to officiating?
I came here and was doing some coaching here on a volunteer basis with a group here in town, and we had a good group of kids, and I helped coach those kids, and then. The core group of kids that I had were all graduated, and I was kind of looking for something else to do. And I teach a coaching basketball methods course. And in that class one day, we were talking about officials, and based on my coaching experience, I told them that I could successfully defend the fact that the Darwinian theory of survival of the fittest was not accurate, because I'd never seen an official who could run, who could see, who could hear, so those people would not exist. If that theory was accurate, and one of my students happened to be an official, and he came up to me after class and said, "Now, coach, that's a little harsh. you should at the very least come out and try it out." And quite frankly, from that conversation, I went to a meeting, became part of the local association, and started officiating at that point.
So how does that work? I mean, people see the officials on TV, but they have no clue how that works. Is that how that works? You start off with a local association, and then you kind of move up?
Today, in today's world, probably over the last 10 years, frankly, right before I got involved with the collegiate officiating, there was a process of camps now. But in the past, I've taught with people, most of the gray hairs that you see on TV, those guys got involved in the game possibly from never even having done high school. They just someone saw them at a rec league or something, and they just moved up the ranks quickly. But now there's a systematic approach. I quite frankly spend money every summer. I go to a camp. I get critiqued by officials.
So they have officiating camps.
Tons of them.
Really?
And I won't go into the details of it. It's a big business. Those guys, it's a big business. And I'll spend quite a bit of money to go to these camps to get critiqued. But on the other side of that, if I get picked up by some of these leagues, there's money in it for me as well. I can make that money back working some of these college games.
And so these specific leagues, and they go to these and basically scout out officials, and they say, Mike, we're going to put you on our roster that we call?
Correct, yeah. So in particular right now, I'm on the Southland Conference roster. So there's a gentleman named Curtis Shaw. And if you know anything about basketball officiating, you can Google him, and he's an interesting character to look at because he's well known for, I think, most famously throwing out, I think, the Temple mascot or someone. He's ejected mascots. he's a tremendous supervisor. I've really enjoyed being under him. But he supervises for the Southland Conference, the Ohio Valley Conference, Conference USA, and the Big 12. And he sort of created a system where he brings in new officials into the Southland, trains them, grooms them, in the hopes that they move up into the Big 12 ranks as those guys kind of move out. Same thing on the other side. The Ohio Valley kind of feeds into Conference USA.
So now when you go to a game, do they keep you from refereeing games here close to College Station? Or do they purposely send you away? Or
I think the primary intent is that you don't engage with any schools that you have an affiliation with. So for instance, Northwestern State, that would obviously try to stay away from them, especially in any sort of conference play. I have refereed some of their games, but it was preseason exhibition. A&M games, I've done some exhibition games, but would not want to work a home game. Just too many students of mine in the stands. I wouldn't want to deal with that. So schools that you have an affiliation with, you want to try to stay away from, just because of the perception. You don't want to create a perception that there could be something going on there.
Yeah. Is there a lot of travel involved?
Lots of travel. Yeah.
And they pay for all that, right? I mean, this is not coming out of your pocket.
There's a flat fee. Okay. So you get paid a flat fee, and you then take care of your travel and expenses based off of that, whatever that fee is. So, I've been to South Louisiana twice this year already. I've got one more trip to go, and I choose to either fly or drive. If I drive, I leave midday on one day and come back I'm back in by 3 or 4 o'clock the next morning after the game. Just drive in and drive back.
Are the officials that you call with, are they kind of from similar distances?
Be from all over. Yeah. I worked a game. The last game I worked, I had an official from. I was from Texas. There was a guy from Kentucky and a guy from Arkansas, and we were working in South Louisiana. So
wow, the one from Kentucky had a long way to go.
He came a long ways.
Wow. Yeah. So, do you know most of the guys you call, or most of the folks that you call games with?
I'm probably acquainted with most of those guys.
Okay.
But the crew I had this last week is my first time I ever called a game with them.
Yeah. I mean, that's the question I have when you watch, you know, some of the basketball games. Do these officials know each other or
well,
not?
Well, the games you're watching on TV, those officials, I guess first thing you have to understand, those guys are, it's not a full-time job, but it really is. I mean, those guys are probably working 70 to 100 games a year.
Wow.
That's three, you know, four, five times a night.
Yeah.
And they're interacting in the same group, so they see each other quite a bit. They've been doing it for a long time, so they know each other pretty well.
Right.
Yeah.
You're still working your way up the ranks.
Still working.
Yeah. What's a dilemma that you've had to face while officiating? Something that sticks out in your mind?
At a high school game, not too far long ago, we had a high school game, and you know, there's this talk about concussions and those kind of things. Probably one of the scariest moments for me, we were at a girls' basketball game. Actually, it was a local game, and had a young lady went to the basket. She went up, and there was no foul on the play. It was just one of those, as we refer to in the game, an inadvertent contact. It was just, you know, it's
got
just there. It just
up,
happened.
Yeah.
And the girl goes to the floor. Her head hits first. I happened to be working with a guy that day who works for the local fire department. And we kind of moved in quickly to her, and he looks at her, and he just kind of glanced to me, and she kind of shook his head. And I mean, she was unconscious, laying on the floor. We immediately, you know, get the people to come out, and coaches come out, and staff come out, and delayed the game for about 10 or 15 minutes. And that's a very sobering moment, you know, when you're standing there watching that. So from that perspective of it, that was kind of one of the more – those moments you don't like at all.
Yeah.
Now, there's tons of stories about – being approached by fans or being approached by coaches, those kind of things. Probably the one that I enjoy telling the most was I was working a little dribblers game. And
Little dribblers.
So these are this group was like 6-7-year-olds, girls.
Wow, okay.
And we're in a city not too far from here, and I make a call. Big girl runs into a little girl, falls to the floor. The little girl falls to the floor, and there's no whistle, and I'm kind of watching them. And the next thing you know, I feel something kind of – I kind of feel it coming up behind me, and I turn and look, and there's Grandpa with his cane, and he's out on the court, and then he is coming after me. But due to my cat-like quickness, he was not able to get me. But, you know, we have those moments as well. So I don't do little dribblers anymore.
No. Just because of the threat of
spectator
violence.
I don't like the canes. I don't like the canes.
What's your favorite parts about officiating?
I think there's two things. One, I love the game of basketball. I just love having an opportunity to play in college. I didn't play any high school sports. Got a chance to play in college, and that just really developed my love for the game. I had some good quality teaching. The game's been very good to me. I've had an opportunity to do things and go places that I couldn't have gone otherwise. So I love the game, and that helps me stay involved in the game without the pressure of wondering about eligibility and who's all that stuff. So the coaching aspect. I can control when I want to be gone, when I want to be home. And the second thing is the camaraderie that we develop. There's still that locker room mentality. I guess if you played on a team, you know there's just something about teammates. But some of my best friends now are guys that I've met through officiating. Mm-hmm. And I've got guys all over the country that I could call, and if I needed something that would be there for me. So
well, and that camaraderie is important. It makes you feel like you're part of something bigger.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bigger than yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we should say, and I just forgot to mention this in the introduction, you did play against Shaquille O'Neal in college.
I did.
So you're talking about the love of the basketball game.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, I had some – he can't refute these stories because he has no idea who I am. But the story I like to tell is that we really sort of dominated that matchup in, you know, the scant 3 minutes I was in the game playing against him. He was a big boy.
Still is.
Still is.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the question that I have to certainly have is when I watch games is how do officials handle angry coaches and angry players? Because, I mean, you certainly have direct interaction with those folks.
I teach some basketball courses here, and I make my classes officiate during our classes. I want them to get a feel for that. But And what I tell them is that to me, basketball officiating is nothing more than just having good communication skills, just understanding how to communicate. And obviously, we all communicate in different ways. And what I would tell you is that different officials will react and respond to coaches acting out in different ways. At the high school level, we've been given some tools to where if a coach kind of acts out, we can warn them, give a verbal warning, walk over, record in the book, and coach, that's your warning.
Right.
If it goes anything beyond that, then everyone knows, and then there's the technical foul, which is just another tool that we have to address coaches. At the collegiate level, I think I kind of know where you're going with this. At the collegiate level, it's interesting because even I hear the messages and memos that I get from my supervisors, from the director of officiating. I see those memos, I read those memos, and then I watch games on TV, and you see coaches acting in ways we're being told to address. Mm-hmm. Now, I've not been in one of those TV games, so I can't tell you how I would respond to that, but it's a challenge when you have a coach who's at a certain level and you have an official at a certain level, and they're telling you to address that coach, and you wonder if you address that, are you going to get is your actions going to be reinforced or supported?
Right,
and it's a challenge.
Or will you be blackballed?
That's exactly right.
Because some of these, my impression is, and I guess one of the things I learned many years ago, some of these coaches will do this stuff on purpose. They're trying to work the officials.
Absolutely, they're going to get an advantage. They're competitors. They're going to try to get any advantage they can. If you go somewhere and I'm with it, I know I've got a game coming up, and it's me, another veteran guy, and a young guy. It's his first year. He's going to get worked, and we're going to have to do a good job of letting him learn on his own, but at the same time letting coaches know that's enough. You can't, get an advantage. So,
when is enough enough from coaches?
My line is, if you personally say something to me, like me, like Mike, you, then that's going to lead to, we're going to address that issue. Anytime you address integrity, you hear the words, you're screwing us. I'm not. Your kid missed 8 free throws. That's not my fault. So anytime we hear that, or every time we come here, you cheat us, that kind of stuff, we're going to address that immediately because, quite frankly, I never go into a game wondering or caring about who wins or loses. That is not part of my obligation.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have places that you don't want to go? And I won't ask you to name those because of some of the environmental
issues. Actually, there's some situations that it's not necessarily environmental stuff, but I typically try to stay away from places. If I've been to a game, to a particular gym, and the coach and I have had an issue, maybe I've teed the coach up, and it was just sort of confrontational. If I've had an issue with a couple of players on that team, I'll stay away from there just because as a coach, I would understand if that official walks in, the players see him, the coaches see him, and it changes the context of that environment. So I would just stay away from that. There's plenty of other places I can go. So I'll just stay out of that just so we don't have that situation that could potentially come up. Yeah.
Do you have much of an issue with angry players? I remember from my playing days I get pissed at the ref, but it was like, as a player, it was like you leave the ref alone.
I think I don't mind players reacting in a respectful manner. You can turn around and say, Mr. Official, that was a terrible call. And if you do it the right way, I'm okay with that. Yeah. What we can't handle is I will not have one player going at another player. If that's any of that, we're going to take care of that. And I'll address a player. I'll try to bring him over and say, hey, come on. I've even gone to a player before. Did you hit him? Did you hit him on the arm? No, Mr. Ref, I didn't. I said, dadgummit, I missed that, didn't I? And just let them know, we're there and we can talk. But I think part of our job is to help them learn accountability as well. And if they go beyond where they're supposed to be, then we're going to hold them accountable for their actions.
Yeah. By the way, I like your sly mention of Michael Jordan's 50th birthday when you recognize jersey number 23 there, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do fans ever get really annoying?
I don't. It's funny how you don't hear fans very much. I think you get to a point where if you're focused enough, that stuff's just kind of background noise. You don't pay much attention to it. Now, I have had some situations where I've had, number one, I would never remove a fan from an establishment. I would have game management or someone else do that because it creates two. I don't want it to be about me. They need to go. And I've had some games where I had to do that. Had a game where my co-official said a guy come on the court chasing me. I didn't even know he was coming on the court. They stopped the game, that kind of stuff.
Did he have a cane?
He did not have a cane. He was a little bit more nimble. I've had police escorts out of gyms, those kind of things. But that's just, you understand that's part of the environment that you go into. Now, I will say occasionally you get a fan that you hear that's just, you just kind of go, that's pretty good. I had a guy tell me one time, it's at a tournament game. There's nobody in the gym. There's about seven people there. And there's a call, and I hear this, I've seen a one-eye or a blind cyclops. That's it. I've seen a blind cyclops referee better than that. And, you know, you just run down the court, and you kind of process that for a little bit. And that's really good. So I come back down the floor, and I kind of make eye contact with him, and I go, that's good. That's really good. He kind of grins and laughs, and, you know, and we just move on from there. But
yeah,
for the most part, if a fan gets to a point where they're distracting players, they're intentionally yelling at players, we're going to address that. We're going to have game administration take care of that problem.
Yeah.
But if they're yelling at me or one of my co-officials, you know.
Does the crowd in general influence referees? I mean, we were at a ball game here the other night where the crowd really got into it, and there were a couple of calls that could be disputed. And, I mean, all of a sudden you've got 7,000 people hollering at you.
Well, you know, I think there's something to that. I think there's I don't know. I'm sure there's some research somewhere that indicate that contextual dependency kind of has an influence on that. Mm-hmm. What we hope is that we're trained good enough and that we're experienced enough that we minimize the impact that can have. And what I do know is that the crowd can influence, you know, coaches can influence the crowd can influence the coaches, and they tend to react emotionally to each other.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons we try not to let coaches get demonstrative, because once they begin to gesture, the crowd gets higher and more excited and more animated, and it's easier to get distracted from what you're trying to do.
I mean, we saw a ball game with a coach. It was one of the women's games where one of the opposing coaches was really good at stomping her foot.
Yeah,
quite a bit. You know, bad call. Yeah. She was over there stomping her foot. I mean, you number one, you think, geez, are you 10 years old? But
yeah, well, I've had those thoughts too about coaches. You know, with some things, you just wonder sometimes the comments they come up with. And you know, I had a guy tell me the other day, and he was accurate. He said, you know, this is my profession. He was talking about his coaching profession.
Mm.
You have another job. Coach, you're right. But tonight, right now, this is my job. This is my profession, and I'm giving you the best effort that I can. And we may agree or disagree on how good that effort is,
right?
And that's fine.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things I would say as an official, we want to leave every game knowing we worked as hard as we could and that we were as consistent as we could be. One of the stories, I had a game with actually one of my colleagues here, Dr. Singer, was in that game as well. And
we did a podcast with him about race relations.
He's actually a very good official. He's doing very well. But he, myself, and another guy were in the game, and been a pretty heated game. A gentleman from one of the teams, as I go run, I know the guy very well. I go running by his bench, and he kind of just looks up at me and said, Mike, just want you to know, you will never work at our place again. I'm like, well, Coach, that's fine. That's okay. There are plenty of places that they'll send me, and that's fine. There's plenty of people to come to your place. Not a problem. Go back down to the other end. The coach on the other end stops me. Mike, just want you to know, this might be the worst officiated game I've ever had. And he's up by 14 at this time, by the way. And I just stopped. I said, Coach, I'm okay with that. The gentleman on the other end just told me the same thing, and I'm fine with that. At the very least, we've been consistent.
Consistent.
So, you know. Right. That's
consistent on both ends.
That's it. Not, whether it was good or bad, we don't know, but we were consistent. So, yeah. And that's what you want to leave every game, knowing that both teams got a fair opportunity.
Yeah. What would you tell people to remember when they want to criticize the officials?
I think there's two things. Number one, from an official, I have to remember that they've got something invested in that emotionally, especially if you're at a high school game. There's parents, there's fans. So they have an emotional investment in what goes on in the court. And as an official, I don't. I've got to remain detached from that. That's the first thing. So as an official, I got to remember that they're going to react to some things, and I've got to be careful how I respond or how I react back to them.
Right.
Coaches and players are a little bit different, but fans, you got to understand that. As an official, I also understand that most fans don't know the game. They don't understand the rules. I didn't know the rules when I started playing and when I started officiating. I thought I did. Come to find out, I didn't know very much at all.
And most people would think they do know
the
rules.
Yeah. And we could probably go through some stuff, and they really don't. But what I would tell, what I tell my students, actually, is we go over the rule stuff in class, and I tell them, go heckle officials. That's fine. I have no problem. That, as a fan, that's part of your right to do. It's your job, right?
Yeah.
But let's do it in a knowledgeable manner. So now when you heckle officials, you know, I give them terminology to use. You know? We talk about, you know, angles, bro, bad angle, ref, because that's the talk we use, you know. And I think the biggest thing is, though, to understand that officials, I have personally, I can say this clearly, I've never been with an official who intentionally made a call to favor one team over another.
Right.
Now,
right.
we may make calls that have that perception, but right. I've never had an official that intentionally did that.
Right.
We don't really care who wins the game.
Kind of our last topic, and you sure. and you just brought this up. What's the most misunderstood rule right now in basketball? The one that maybe most people think they know, but they don't.
I think the most common one that people that I speak to my students about, the most common one is a travel rule. I think I would say as an official, number one, it's the hardest thing to call in the game. Some people say the block charge, but block charge, you're either going to get it right or wrong. You're going to make it or not make it.
You got a 50% chance.
Yeah, but the travel is tough because the game's changed so much with the influx of European players. The way that kids play today is different than it was in the past. And
people would say, traveling's two steps. Should be pretty easy.
It should be.
How has the game changed that makes that more difficult?
It's bigger, stronger, faster at every level. Girls' game, guys' game. College game, players are bigger, stronger, faster. That means my first initial look, when a player catches the basketball, I try to find a pivot foot, but then I'm looking at contact. I'm going, is there a foul? Because most coaches want to foul before they want to before they want to travel. So that's the concept. And then they're moving through a mass of people, and you're trying to discover, was it one step, two steps? Did they jump stop? Did they pivot? Did they turn? Did they lift a foot? Because you can take left, right, and as long as the left doesn't come back again, you can put the right up. So there's a lot that goes into that. Was the ball in control? Did they have possession? Was there established pivot? The most common one's a kid jumps on the floor. The ball is a loose ball. Kid runs and dives on the ball and slides 12 feet and stops.
Yeah.
Everyone screams travel, 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 but it's not because he doesn't establish a pivot until he stops. Now, it could be left cheek, could be right cheek, could be,
depending on which part of his body
that's
his pivot.
But
right.
at that point, now we have the potential for a travel to take place.
Yeah.
But if they release the ball, they can dribble to stand up. There's no travel. And that's a very common one.
Yeah. There's also one where I've seen this recently where kids will bat the ball around. One kid will bat it around and grab it both hands and then start dribbling again. The first thought is double dribble, but it's
Well, you must have control. Yeah. So if I've controlled the ball and I put it to the floor, that's one dribble. Then if I lose it again, I fumble it, I can pick it up again.
Right.
But if I fumble it and then it goes to the ground, and then I can continue the dribble from there. So there's that fumble, dribble, fumble kind of deal. And
interesting stuff. I'm getting the sign that we're running out of time.
Sure.
Really been great to have you here. Yeah. What would be your take-home message?
Well, I think there's two things. One, for other people, I'm not sure what it is, but I think for me it's this. Every time I approach a game of basketball, the first thing I consider is that it's not about me, it's not about my crew, it's about those kids on the court. We want them to have the best experience that they can have. Did a playoff game last night, one of the teams lost, that was it. There were about four seniors, that's the last high school basketball game they're going to play. And that's important. It's important that we go out and give them great effort on that. And I think that's so applicable in other things that we do, that when I'm out there officiating, I'm also a mentor and a role model on occasions for kids. And sometimes I'm the one that has to step in and adjudicate and be the authority figure or the disciplinarian, but I've got to do that in a way that's positive and that's not reactionary to some of the things that they might be doing. So the big idea is that if we're talking about from an officiating perspective, is that they're human, they're going to make mistakes. Accept that going in. Still yell at them.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. But just accept the fact that officials are going to make mistakes and that they don't really care, who beats who.
Right.
And that's kind of one little takeaway, I guess.
That's another one of those aspects of the game, right?
Yep.
That's part of the
part
game.
Part of it. Part of the game.
Thank you again for being with us today.
Sure.
We didn't even get to talk about your day job. So we'll have to bring you back and talk to you about your day job at some point. And thank you all for listening today. As always, we have our take-home podcast T-shirt question, and here with the question today is Cheryl.
What is one way an official can penalize a coach for unnecessary actions?
That was a great question, Cheryl, and be the first person to email us the correct answer to that to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast T-shirts. Don't hesitate, but don't ever think that your answer is too late. Send us an answer whenever you've got it. Again, thanks for being with us today, Mike. Enjoyed it.
Sure, my pleasure.
Sure. And again, thank you all for taking the time to download us and listen this week. Until next week, when we'll have another interesting person in sports medicine and human performance with us, we hope that you stay active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Cheryl Marek and Kelly Selman and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.